What I'd like to do now is just take a couple of minutes and talk a little bit about the proofs for the existence of God that St. Thomas Aquinas developed. Now, he developed it in, you might say, kind of in concert with one of the ancient Greek philosophers, Aristotle, who, in his own way and without the benefit of divine revelation, he came very close to the issue of the existence of God without knowing God himself. You know, he was not Jewish, obviously. It was long before Christianity. So he didn't have the benefit of divine revelation. So just on the basis of his sheer intellectual inquiry, he was able to put together a series of proofs, as he saw them, for the existence of God. And it might be worthwhile to go through that so that we can consider how you might talk about the existence of God. So in no particular order. Now, in some scenarios or some settings, you might find them presented in a particular order. But let's just talk about them in no particular order. So the first one that I'll discuss anyway is the argument from motion. Now, motion can be understood in a couple of ways. One is the motion of an object through space. So locomotion, an object moving through space from point A to point B. We recognize this because we live it all the time. You're always moving. And all of the component parts of your body are always moving, even down to the submolecular level. There's motion going on. You'll notice that when a person dies, and it doesn't even just have to be a person, it could be a dog, could be a plant, could be a tree. You take any living being that dies and the life principle goes out of it. What do you notice? You notice, first of all, it stops moving. Not only does the animal itself, you know, Rover, he stops running around, wagging his tail and such, and he's now motionless. Because why? Because he's dead. But if you were to look deeper into the physical structure of the dog or any living thing for that matter, you'll notice that all the component parts of that thing also stop moving. So the molecules are no longer moving. The atoms, the electrons, the neutrons, all those things that are moving constantly in the body cease. So the movement stops. This is movement, locomotion from point A to point B. So from that, we can discern that there's something going on here, that there is an animating principle that causes Rover to wag his tail and to run around and bark and to move as dogs do. And without that animating principle, he no longer does it because he's now dead. The same is true for the electrons, the atoms, and all those parts of the body that are moving. There's something that was making them move, and that thing is now gone, therefore it no longer moves. So we experience this constantly in the form of death, the death of things. So one thing we can learn from that is that things move because something makes them move. Something is causing those component parts in your body to move, to vibrate, to oscillate. There's something that's making it move. Now, in the case of a human being, this is true of animals, but in a lesser sense, because we have, as human beings, a rational soul, it's our soul that's animating the body. This is why philosophers point out that the soul is the form of the body. The soul is the organizing principle. Your soul is what organizes your body. It's what animates your organs. It's what makes your heart beat. It's what makes all of those things move. And if the soul separates from the body, you die and everything stops moving. So the key here is to realize that there's something required that's outside of the things that are moving to make them move. Another example, let's say you and your buddies, you want to play some billiards, and you go into the billiard room and you rack up the balls and you're chalking your pool sticks. And before anyone had a chance to hit the cue ball to break up the other balls that had just been racked up, what if all of a sudden all the balls on the billiard table started moving on their own? You would immediately, without hesitation, you would immediately be thinking, why are these balls moving and what's the cause of it? Is there an earthquake? Is there a wind? Is the house tilting on its foundation? Because there would have to be some cause that would make those billiard balls move from their stationary place. And if there wasn't a cause, if there was no wind, and there was no earthquake, and the house is not tilting on its foundation, and nobody bumped the table, and there's no other external cause for those billiard balls to be moving around on the table, I'm pretty confident you would probably get out of that room very quickly, because you'd think, is this haunted? What's going on here? it would be frightening if you saw billiard balls moving on their own accord on a billiard table. This is one of those odd things about life. You notice how we're frightened by things that should move but don't, like, you know, a dead body. And we're also frightened by things that shouldn't move and do. So St. Thomas was pointing out merely that all around us we see motion taking place constantly, and we recognize instinctively that things that are in motion are set in motion by something else. Okay. The other part of motion and the argument from motion is change. Now, change is a type of motion in itself. It's a movement from what we can think of as potentiality to act. And all that really means is that things have the potential to be different from how they are. They could be different, and often they become different. Well, I shouldn't say often. Constantly, everything is becoming different. You're getting older. Things get bigger. Things get smaller. Things get broken. An acorn that you fling into the forest, you come back 30 years later, there's an oak tree. So it changed. So there's this constant change that's going on. Things are moving from what we consider potency or the potentiality to become something. They're moving to what they can become. So this Dixie cup, this white plastic styrofoam, I'm sorry, white styrofoam Dixie cup full of water, which is imaginary because I don't have one with me, but let's say I do. It's full of water right now. It could be empty, but it's not because it's full. But if I tip it over and pour out all the water, it's now empty. So that cup had the potential to be empty. It wasn't, but then it became empty. So that's a movement in terms of change, things getting older, etc. And the same phenomenon is explained in the same way. So things that change don't change unless there's a change agent that causes the change, something external to it that causes it to change. And if there is no external agent, if I were not holding the cup in my hand and saying, well, it could be emptied, and then turn my hand upside down to empty the cup, it would not be emptied. It would stay full.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So with that in mind, let's consider then this universe that we inhabit, not just our bodies, but also this planet and the galaxy and the universe itself and everything in it. Everything is in motion. Not only is it in locomotion, but it's also changing. The universe is expanding. Things are getting older. Things break. Things are destroyed. They come into and out of existence. So we have all this motion, and it can't be explained on its own basis. In other words, the things that are moving are moved by other things, but ultimately all of this movement that began, I guess, with the Big Bang and all of this motion outward started at a certain point eons ago, that had to have a cause, because nothing is moving that isn't set in motion by something else, as we've already proposed. So the prime mover, who is itself not moved by anything else, but is necessary in order to start the process going, that being we call God. Quick example of what I'm talking about. You see a train go by, and at the very end of the train, you see the caboose. Now, you know the caboose is being, you can see it, it's moving right in front of you, but you know that the only way it can move is by being pulled by the car that it's hitched to, the car in front of it. But you know that that car is only moving because it's hitched to the car in front of it, and so on and so forth. And it doesn't matter how long this train is. This train could be 10 cars long. This train can be a trillion, trillion, trillion cars long. Doesn't matter. All that we know is that at the very front of this train, however long it might be, there must be an engine that is pulling it, because if there's no engine that is not being moved by something else but is pulling everything else, then none of those cars can move. And yet you see them all moving. So basic logic shows us that there must be some agent that set this motion into process, otherwise none of these things could move. So again, this being, or this cause, we could say, that causes all the motion and the change, we call God. So that's one example. Another example would be called causality, or efficient causality, which is a more appropriate term for it. In other words, it affects the cause. You know, we think about cause and effect. Efficient causality is simply a way of saying that nothing comes into existence on its own. Nothing comes into existence by itself. It's brought into existence. You were brought into existence. So in your body, that was the result of the physical union of your parents. Had that not happened, you wouldn't be here. God created your soul, but your parents together created your body. The microphone I'm speaking into right now in this studio, it was created in a manufacturing plant somewhere. It was created in the mind of the person who designed it. It was created at the factory where the parts were assembled, and it was turned into a functioning microphone. It didn't just come into existence on its own. Nothing comes into existence on its own. Nothing can give itself existence, in other words. Being is something that you being is something that you receive. So whether it's your body or your house or this planet or this galaxy or even the universe itself, everything we can see is caused by something outside of it and before it. This is why it's completely illogical to say that the universe is eternal. That's an impossibility, logically speaking, rationally speaking, because we have evidence all around us, without exception, that things that come into existence are brought into existence by something else. So the universe can't just be here forever and ever. Something had to cause it. We call that cause, the first cause, we call that God. Because without God, none of these other things could have happened. They could not have come into existence. Now, who created God? That's kind of a dumb question, but sometimes you hear people say that. Nobody created God. By definition, God is the first cause, and he's the uncaused cause. Nobody created God. He has always existed. And if he didn't always exist, nothing could exist. If there wasn't some pre-existent and eternally existent thing, being, entity, whatever term you'd like to use, I call him God, but use whatever term you prefer, then nothing could exist. But yet things do exist, and they're brought into existence by previous causes. That had to begin somewhere. So if you walk into a room and you hear piano music and you see that, oh, there's a lady at the piano and she's playing the music, the reason you hear the music is because she's playing the piano. And if she were to take a break and get up and walk away from the piano, the music stops. Why does it stop? Because she's no longer causing it to be there. It's there because she caused it. If she's not doing what's necessary to cause the music stops. Or it doesn't start in the first place. So there we have the first two, motion and causality. Now let's talk about what's called contingency. Now, contingency doesn't mean like, you know, what's your contingency plan? If this doesn't work out, it doesn't mean contingency in that sense. Contingency in this context refers to necessity, or as the case may be, a lack of necessity. And what we mean by this is that things exist, we see them, but we know that they're not necessary to exist because at one time they didn't exist. So you yourself are not absolutely necessary to exist, and the easiest proof is that however long it was ago that you were born, you go back a second, well, not born, but let's say conceived, you go back a second, a day, a week, a month before that, you didn't exist. So at one time, you were not here, and yet you are here, and this planet is here, and this solar system and galaxy, indeed, the universe itself is here. But none of these things need to be here because at one time they didn't exist. Going back to the Big Bang again for a second, we're still wondering what banged. We don't know yet. I have a pretty good idea. I would say that's God who spoke things into existence. But in any case, science will catch up with that in due time. In the meantime, if we just consider this scientifically and rationally, we see that we have this entire universe filled with contingent, i.e. unnecessary beings, things that exist. And they didn't have to exist because at one time they didn't exist, and yet they do exist. So how did this all start? Well, that must require, it's an inevitable conclusion here, it must require something that necessarily exists, that must exist in order for anything else to exist. And if this first necessary being didn't exist, nothing could exist. I hope you follow the logic here. And so this is what St. Paul is referring to in Romans when he talks about that nobody has an excuse to not believe in God. All you have to do is look around. Look at the cosmos and you see, even at an elementary sort of rational 2 and 2 equals 4 sort of process, you can see that we have all these things that don't need to be here, but they are here. There must be something that must exist in order for any of these things to exist. Then let's talk about degrees of perfection. Now, degrees of perfection is, you know, it's a subtle way of looking at this, but it's a way of considering that in this life we recognize that some things tend toward perfection and other things tend away from perfection. So you know you know, a line that's not quite straight. You know it's not quite straight because you know what a straight line is. You can compare it to a perfectly straight line or a perfectly round circle. Now, we recognize this not just in objects, but we recognize it in other things like things are hotter, things are cooler, things are better, things are worse. So our whole existence is bound up in recognizing things on a spectrum of degree or spectrum of gradation, tending toward our ideal of the perfect and tending away from it. So St. Thomas, building upon what Aristotle had to say, he's simply pointing out that that would be impossible in an ultimate sense if there was not some ultimate standard of good, some ultimate standard of perfection. Everything would be purely relative and subjective. So this is one of those arguments for the existence of God that points to all around us we see this, these degrees of perfection, but in order for that to have any real meaning or intelligibility, there must be some ultimate standard of perfection by which things are ultimately measured. And then lastly, this harkens back to the discussion we had a few minutes ago, and this has to do with design. And I won't belabor this point because we already talked about it, but it's simply to say that as you consider the physical universe, the cosmos, you see a vast orderly system that's governed by laws. You might ask, why isn't everything just chaos? Why are things governed by laws? Where do these laws come from? Why is it that chemical molecules, they in chemistry, they bind in a certain way, or they repel each other in a certain way? They produce certain reactions when you combine certain molecular combinations. Why is that? Why is it always that way? Why are these laws seemingly immutable throughout the universe? Now, we don't have to get into Einstein and his theory of relativity and those kinds of things. That's a little deeper water than we're able to go into on a radio program. But nonetheless, we see all around us this very, you might say, constant set of rules that suggest design. We talked about the various things in the universe that are so fine-tuned that if you were to go a slight degree or a fraction of a degree in one way or the other, life couldn't exist. And yet it does exist. And the complexity of DNA and how it is a code, its information in a precise sequence, all of these things, of course, point to a designer. So there's a lot that we could say about all five of these different ways of looking at the existence of God. They're not proofs in a strict sense, but I would say they're strong arguments that point inexorably, in my view, toward the existence of God. Now, you'll notice I never quoted the Bible. I never invoked Jesus Christ. One could do those things, but if you're talking to a secular person who doesn't believe in those things anyway, that's not going to do you much good. So my advice would be to master these basic concepts so that you can bring them up in a conversation and then maybe ask your atheist friend, well, how do you explain it? If God doesn't exist, how do you explain this? That would lead to a very interesting conversation, if you ask me. I'm looking forward to a conversation with you when we return. My number is 888-914-9149.
For more of The Patrick Madrid Show, visit relevantradio.com/Patrick.